So you got this idea where when you start a sentence and the words all follow each other, right? And then poets and madmen and madwomen will use words that are separating this kind of expected meaning, right? Projected meaning, right? And really great poets will push it to the very end, their very thing. So you're getting a real wide separation between one word and the next. So you're, as you're hearing it, you're going, God, I'm getting a little disoriented, right? But I can still kind of see what's going on. Mallarmé, just in the 19th century, by smoking a lot of marijuana and opium, just expanded, just moved the interval between one word and the next in terms of metaphorical meaning, you know, to a magnitude. And I've read it in the French, and it's just as easy to understand in the French, because in the English, it's totally fucking
it's totally incomprehensible.
At least I have the illusion of, like, I might know what these words
mean.
Yeah,
it's like Beckett. Yeah, you're like, well, it's so difficult to understand in the French. Maybe in a weird way, it actually grounds it.
Exactly. Yeah. You're just totally disoriented, so. But yeah, that's Mallarmé, and again, Edward Said mentions him in the same breath as Beckett and Joyce and Flaubert, strangely enough.
What do you think the end goal of this kind of disconfiguration of language is? And, not deconstruction, because a poet is not a deconstructionist.
I like the either disconfiguration or deconfiguration. Either one works. Mm. Yeah. Well, I mean, we all try to get there. What the French are saying is, this is just a normal situation. And when you see how crazy people get, they get crazy through language.
Yeah.
That's how they become crazy, is listening to themselves and talking to themselves.
Listening to themselves, yeah.
Yeah, and it's great when a brilliant person like Shakespeare or somebody listens to himself talking, or you and I. But when somebody really fucked up does, now you've really got problems.
Or, you know, like, I was trying to use this as a metaphor, and my girlfriend constantly accuses me of being bad at metaphor or analogy. She's like, you're just not good at it. Which is probably, as a writer, the most hurtful thing.
You got the greatest woman ever.
Someone can say.
You got
it's like, they really know how to push the button. It's like, you're just not good at analogy. It's like, oh, that's like what I spent my whole life trying to be good at.
What a woman you got. And she's Jesus. Gorgeous, too. God, she's got it all.
No, you don't. I'm back to ugly women after this. Anyway, so she, like, I was trying to tell her, okay, so there's this thing in youth culture where they call things like trigger warnings, right? Have you heard this?
Mm-hmm.
About how someone can trigger you, and you can be
if you pre-see it, it doesn't trigger you so much.
Or what my analogy was, like, well, okay, the trigger is an important part, but just as important is the gun you've already built inside yourself. Like, if someone pulls the trigger on you and there's no ammunition in it, it just goes click, and it's scary, and your nervous system has a reaction to it, but it's not a pop, it's not an actual fire, and you can go even farther than that.
And she said you were not good at metaphor. This woman I think she's just like teasing you, because that's one of the greatest metaphors ever. Yes, we all have the gun in us. And the really brilliant, you know, sadistic people know that's what your trigger is, you know. And they can see you've got that gun there, so they use that. Yeah, that's tremendous.
Yeah.
That's tremendous, Jonah. Yeah.
But I think some...
Of course, you're the guy that told me about women are a soft gun.
Oh, yeah. I totally
or women know how to use the soft gun.
Yeah.
Right.
I've been really into...
No wonder we're not that popular. Metaphors. No wonder we're not that popular on Oprah Winfrey.
How old is Oprah Winfrey now? You think she's 90? Your age?
90.
She's older than you?
Well, maybe she's... Oh, God, I know she is, yeah. Color Purple was like 1968.
What does that have to do with Oprah Winfrey?
I was only 18 in 1968. She was... That's how she became famous. She was the beautiful black woman that got the shit beat out of her.
Oh, she was by an actress Southern cop. First.
Oh, absolutely, man. Oh. Color Purple is a great movie. And it's a great movie. And all the actors, the lead big black guy, I can't remember his name. I mean, he's a real prick, man. I mean, he's a patriarchal prick himself. But that doesn't compare to the white guy that beats the hell out of cute little Opry. And so she's got she's blind in one eye. This is a real shit, man. It's a great movie.
Huh. Who's the writer of The Color Purple again?
Alice Walker.
Alice Walker. Okay. Yeah. I haven't read hers as much as I've read... who wrote Tar Baby again?
Morrison, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Morrison. I've read more of her stuff.
Yeah.
But...
Beloved is just a fantastic book.
Yeah, I tried to read jazz, and I was just kind of like, eh.
That's what we're talking about. I mean, you and I, you know, just writing in obscurity. Nobody's reading all our bad books.
Okay, this is one thing I was going to ask you about. How did you, or I, ever become convinced anyone would give a shit about what we would write? Like, how did this happen? Is this like a supreme delusion? Like, how did this start happening in our lives?
Through language. Through language. That's what the French say. Language disorients you and takes control of you and drives you fucking crazy. Because, I mean, you read Keats, you read this beautiful poetry, or Hemingway, or Steinbeck, anybody, or Anis Nin. I mean, you hear this language and you get these codes that seem to be, you know, to represent what we've experienced. And we just fall in love, man. We just want to participate. It's why they're amateur musicians in every town, man. And they just waste their lives away just playing music and nobody really gives a fuck. Because they can hear really great musicians on the radio every day, you know. And they do it. I mean, God, me... I just love to write. That's just how it is, man. This is the happiest time of my life right now. I'm doing the final rewrite on the last book, and I'm just like, I'm feeling it, man. It's just like being in a basketball game where you're just making the shots, man.
You're not in the NBA. You're in a pickup basketball game.
I'm in a pickup basketball game. Somewhere in Pocatello, Idaho, man. Yeah, exactly so.
But it still feels the same.
It feels just as good for me as it feels for those guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Fuck, and so now we get to feeling, right? And that's what all these dickhead French forget, man. It's all somatic, man. It's all feeling. I mean, language is feeling. Good writers, you feel it, man. You feel the language. Bad writers, it's like bang. You know, somebody banging a rock against a road or something.
Wow, yeah.
Goddamn, I'm sure being brilliant tonight, man, and you as well.
Well, yeah.
This is August 12th.
Yeah.
8/12, well, man. Well,
pretty much this is our 5-year anniversary, or maybe even 6-year anniversary.
Really?
Yeah.
Isn't that great? Pretty congratulations. Close.
Yeah. We went up in our listenership for a minute, and now we're back down to basically where we started. So.
Right. Right.
It's you know, that's...
Well, this is going to drive it even lower.
Yeah.
Because I'm telling you, man, I'm just right on it tonight. And you are, too.
As soon as we're on it. This
Yeah, true story, man.
Oh,
no, you become overwhelmed by language and music as well. But, you know, let's not be arbitrary. We become overwhelmed by beautiful, kind women, brilliant women. We become rivers. Just clouds. It's amazing how many novels that I kind of pick up and I'll go, you know, I might be in prison, but I can see the clouds, right? And I'm thinking, yeah, this guy's got it. This guy's...
Yeah.
You know?
As long as you can see the clouds.
It's the whole thing, man. But, I mean, that's what I'm saying. That's my only critique of Edward Said and all these academics is that language is just part of the thing, man. They're always trying to say language is representative of the whole thing. It's not, man. We spend a lot of time just feeling and experiencing and loving, you know, and then the language comes in. But it's not like you're talking to yourself when you're fucking making love, man.
Yeah,
Some people may.
I do a little bit.
I knew you were going to say that. It was a great setup. Yeah. That was a great tip in.
Yeah. It's hard to avoid.
Your girlfriend's going to love that line.
Well, I think that's the whole point.
And she's going to say, I knew you were. I knew you were.
Yeah. And you're thinking about other women, too,
no,
aren't you?
No, she's saying how... you're just thinking how about fucking how great you are, you know?
No.
Oh, my gosh. I hope she listens to this. She's going to love it.
Oh, my God.
Because I'm on her side, man. She's
I'm
great.
Glad. Well, the whole world can be on her side. I don't give a fuck. Everyone can be against me. That's fine. That's fine. I don't give a shit.
I'm beating the bass drum in the chorus here.
I don't...
It's hot, man. It's August.
Yeah.
It's August. Women... My wife just fucking headed out of town, man. She said goodbye. Here's the house. Here's the dog. Here's the instructions. It's true, man. I remember that great... Everybody... Look. We have not mentioned Sherwood Anderson.
In a while, yeah.
Who's I think the greatest American writer. Well, you know how I like to hyperbolize.
Yeah.
But he writes about August in Chicago, and it's so no air conditioning, and the milk is spoiling, and the kids are crying, and the guy just gets back from fucking getting his ass kicked, you know, in whatever foundry or meatpacking place he is. And, you know, blood is on the floor, man. It's just a matter of how bad it's going to be, how much blood is going to be let. And that's where you are right now, man. It's just fucking, it's just how it is, man. And you get in this flow of, and Shakespeare gets it too. But Sherwin Anderson in that one short story, man, I'm just really glad that sweet little babe of mine's out of town, because it's just a matter of time in August. Heat, man. You know, us Scandinavians, man, we can... It doesn't matter how cold it is. We can just put more on clothing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But man, you're in a hot fucking apartment, and why aren't we in the Bahamas? Why aren't you Elon Musk? You know, all this shit. It's like, fuck, man. Or you just walk out the door, man. But it worked out for me because you brought a six pack of sake.
Yeah. Well, what I get is the very confusing. I have told you exactly how to behave with me, and yet you don't do that. And I am almost completely sure she has not told me how to exactly behave. I'm almost certain she hasn't told me.
Well, this is the whole thing with the French, between the written and the spoken. She should at least write it down.
Yeah. If it was going to be a list of do this on this day.
Right. I mean, just look at any legal thing. What it's in a text on a telephone, it's been written down, or it's a memo. There's none of this. He said this, I said this. No, I'm sorry, man. It does not go in a court of law.
And I'm sure that would go over great.
Hey, look, I'll be on your side. On top of that, Jonah, I'm going to come over there tonight with Shota, and I'm going to take you two to dinner, and it'll work out just as well as it did at the Fort Hall Casino.
Yeah.
Where, gentle reader, we were escorted out of Fort Hall for drunkenness? Are you fucking kidding me? How is this possible?
I don't remember. I'm going to lean into this like I'm Hunter S. Thompson and be like... Be like, yeah, those fucking pigs. I don't know why I'm a 1920s. Anyway.
Well, it's true. It happened, man. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I sit right across from the Oasis Bar, Jonah, where once or twice a week, some poor Indian kid comes out and is so drunk, they just kind of push him out the door, and he falls on his head, and he bounces three times, and then he lays there for a while. And you and I and Stacy got
escorted. You're much better writer than me.
You got you and
you know how to, you know, like, just hit a beat, you know, like, bounced his head three times. What is his head, a bouncy ball? Like, how did his head bounce three
times? How about the old you know, janitor comes out with a broom and actually sweeps around him? I was going, are you kidding me, man? And then as he gets up and walks down the street, he sweeps it after him. I mean, this is just like America, man. Yes, just serve some human being like 25 shots of alcohol, take all their money, and when they pass out, you just kind of move them down the street and then sweep the broom after them. I couldn't believe it. But even more was the irony of me going out to the Fort Hall Casino and being able to drink on reservation time for the first time since I've been here. And we get fucking escorted out of there. There was such injustice there. And we were the only ones in the bar.
That casino is so sad looking.
Beautiful on the outside.
It's just like everything in this part of the country. It's like Pocatello has the world's worst strip club. Honestly, it's the worst. If there was anyone who's going
to challenge... The 91 Club?
Yes. Oh, my God. It's the... It's
you are an expert in strippers.
I'm pretty, yeah.
You are the authority.
I'm as close to an authority as you're going to get about not, you know, who doesn't own a strip club or who is not a stripper. But, oh, my God, that... Yeah.
Right.
There's so many places around here that are just... But yet... That is what I love about this place. It's just like seeing failure, you know? Like, and in a weird way, it's okay, you know? Like, there's something about being in these planned communities where it's like failure isn't an option. And it gets a little cloying. It gets a little, you know?
Cloying is the word. Gated communities. Oh, we're all so... Yeah.
Yeah,
it's... No, you got it, man. That's why we love Pocatello, man. Failure.
It's never going anywhere.
No, in the periphery, I mean, they're building all these beautiful developments all around town. Yeah, as long as... But you know what saves Pocatello is the wind that blows every afternoon. Mm-hmm. Like right now, gentle reader, it's like 92 out there. But that wind is blowing. And you walk outside and it's like, I can sit outside any bar in this town and just be the happiest person alive. Especially with Shota.
This is Will's grand... Great Pyrenees mix
with the golden eyes.
Yeah,
he's been barking at people all day today. After about 3 o'clock, he said, "I'm through with this." And what was really spectacular was, I went to the back, and all of a sudden, and after I'd fed him treats and said, "Okay, you're gonna mellow out," and I'd had him inside, he is like barking really loud. And guess what? It was because he knew Jonah. Jonah was in the door, and he knew he could bark as loud as he wanted. And I came up, and Jonah's giving him a big hug and patting him on the head. Oh, yeah. Look at that.
He has the most expressive eyes. He has one of the more expressive eyes I've ever seen in a dog.
If he were an actor, it would be like...
Yeah. Like, he should be a Hollywood dog.
He's looking at us right now is that it's time to go. It's time for me to eat. And I have been a hero here. I have been in the emergency ward taking care of people for like 24 hours. And she's got big brown eyes. It's time for me to go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, yes.
We're really getting back to the podcast roots of not having anything substantial to talk about and just talking.
This is the best one ever. No, I think it is. It's got a simplicity to it.
Yeah, simplicity's good. Yeah.
Thematic simplicity.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, the details weren't that great, but the theme was pretty damn good. True story, man.
The essence and not the substance. Not sure I'm happy with that. Well, let's try and throw in some high-mindedness.
Great.
Okay. This is just something I picked out of your Edward Said book that you said you were reading. And I just picked a little quote because I love little quotes. And why I brought up Mallarmé in the beginning. Mallarmé's project, that of enclosing all possible discourse within the fragile density of the word, within that slim, material black line traced by ink upon paper, is fundamentally a reply to the question imposed upon philosophy by Nietzsche. For Nietzsche, it was not a matter of knowing what good and evil were in themselves, but of who was being designated, or rather, who was speaking. To the Nietzschean question, who is speaking, Mallarmé replies and constantly reverts to that reply by saying that what is speaking is, in its solitude, in its fragile vibration, in its nothingness, the word itself. Not the meaning of the word, but its enigmatic and precarious being. Whereas Nietzsche maintained his questioning as to who is speaking right up to the end, Mallarmé was constantly effacing himself from his own language to the point of not wishing to figure in it except as an exultant in a pure ceremony of the book in which the discourse would compose itself.
Edward Said, spectacular. It's one of the greatest sentences ever written, man, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
The great writing is literary criticism now, Jonah. No, that's fantastic. I agree completely. It's unbelievably good.
I really like it. I'm still not 100% sure what it
is. Well, you got to read Mallarmé. I mean, obviously you got to read Mallarmé. Yes. Because, you know, what I said earlier in the podcast, that verifies. I mean, he's really out there. And you don't understand it, but you don't care. So it's kind of like language unbridled. It's like image unbridled. It's like feeling unbridled.
Who can handle
But he
that?
Doesn't, but he doesn't, he leaves out the word feeling, which I think...
But who are we to expect to be able to handle that shit? Like, who are we, like, when you expect a participant, don't you like, is it not our job to, like, understand what they're able to understand? Like,
that's a great title. The expectation of the participant is like the essence of life, man.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. You always come through with one great fucking line every podcast.
Well, I'm glad you think so.
I come up with these solemnities, but no, that's absolutely right. We all have this expectation of the participant, man. That's what we want in life. That's what every child wants. That's what every dog wants.
Yeah.
Do they get it? Fucking rarely.
Right. Right. And that's the problem. And I think that's the problem.
That is the fucking problem.
That's
man.
The problem is writers were trying to solve for them, for us, for right. everyone. It's like... Your fucking expectation about what's going to happen here is not going to happen.
It could.
It could, maybe. One in a million times, or, you know, like, maybe even less than that. One in 100 times. But chances are, your life is just going to be your life. Their life is just going to be their life. Words are going to be words.
You're wiser now than you even realize. Okay. That's really the essence of it. And that's why there are so many good writers that fail most of the time, but every once in a while they hit it, and the reader is able to participate, and the reader's happy, you know.
Yeah.
But no, it's really true, man.
And I mean, maybe that's a minor miracle.
The expectation of participation is like the essence of life, and it's like success factor of like 2%, man. 2%. You know, but I gotta say, man, if you live long enough, it'll happen. And what happens if you live long enough, like I have, you recall people that did participate with you, you know, and were there. And man, but yeah, it's, it's a really a crazy thing. We are in this like polar, like quarterly opposite right now, because I'm with this woman who like participates with me every moment. It's like, what the heck? I've never experienced this. So yeah, hats off to Sanai, man, because she's the bomb. And that's the reason I love her. It's like, I mean, look, you've been on hikes with me. You've had me describe dinners, right? By the way, she's always repeating, yeah, half-baked potato. So, gentle reader, every time I say, this is really great, Jonah said, yeah, Will, doesn't matter. We had a dinner in which the potatoes were half-baked, and he says it's the greatest dinner ever. So, Sanai remembers this. It repeats it every time.
No way. Go,
God damn, yeah, she does. She loves it. But she's ironic. She's got this sense of irony because she participates. I mean, we go on walks. I'm going, isn't this fun walking around Idaho State University campus?
And she's like, yeah, it's a half-baked potato.
Look at that. You know, look, you're going to go over and like actually bang on that stupid sculpture to see whether it's got tonality. She doesn't care, man. It's just, it's so fantastic. But yeah, I think, and you know, the great professor we had here, Levinson, professor of philosophy, he said, you know, the act of reading is one of the greatest acts of generosity ever. You know, when you write and a writer participates with you, that's a really a great thing, man.
That's true. I think it's a very...
Carl Levinson.
Yeah. It's a very simple point to hit, but it's a necessarily simple point to hit of allowing yourself to just read something, just, you know, like not have a, you know, it's just
he
like,
throws you a bad pass, you try to pick it up, man.
Yeah.
You know, it's true. Yeah. It's true. Yeah, you don't.
You're
hold
terrible it at metaphors, yeah, Will.
You're right. It was a lame one, but you know, yeah.
You need to up your analogies.
I know.
No, I know. Sorry.
But it's true. Just a comment. I mean, how many people do you play with? You give them a bad pass. Well, I mean, that's why I love you, man. You know, I throw you all these fucking stupid lines, and you always try to pick them up somehow, man. And other people just watch them go by and went, oh, I don't know, man. And then you got like, as Saeed is talking about, you don't pick up the pass, or you don't try to, and all of a sudden you've got this big hole. Time now is full of these holes. And that, according to him, this is my critique of Saeed, is that's what he says, is that's alienation, where you've got these points of like, boom, there's nothing happening here. That's alienation, right?
I could actually listen to you talk about this for 15 minutes if you can expand on it.
I can't because I just opened it up today, but that's one of the things I picked up by reading it.
No, but that was, I really synced up with what you were saying.
Yeah. Well, here's Edward Said, because he kind of put it in my head. Yeah. But you came up with a line about, you know, the refusal to participate. Fuck, man. What's the point? You know? Fuck, that's, you know, that was a great thing about when I was a lad, was like, and bombing in academia and coming back, you know, and like you, and working, you know, construction jobs, man. But I actually ran into, you know, real ill-educated rednecks that would kind of like try to figure out what the hell I was talking about, man. You know, I've always thought a lot of them because they had no fucking idea what I was talking about. They were kind of looking at me like, oh, yeah, I get what you're saying. It was great.
Well, it sort of imbibes you with this idea of, like...
generosity, well, basically.
Yeah.
basically what we want out of people is generosity. Come on, let's have a little generosity. That's all it is. That's what it's all about. If somebody bores the fuck out of you for like a half an hour, yeah, that's, there's a limit, but
yeah.
But yeah.
But also I think like with those interactions, when you have those blue collar interactions, you have moments where you, where it's like, okay, these people haven't participated in this in any way, and yet I can still cross that boundary. Right. It's just how do I cross that boundary? Mm-hmm. And that is very tantalizing because you're like, ah, it's almost like the worst superhero movie of all time, of a superhero who's like constantly trying to be a superhero but just never succeeds. Like, like they just spend their whole life obsessed with the idea of becoming a superhero. It just never works. And they're always slightly frustrated. And like every once in a while someone's like, yeah, okay, that was all right. And they're like, oh, yes. And
absolutely, man. Absolutely. You know, I was thinking of the overarching title of my three novels, Crawl on Your Belly Like a Man, The Ghosts, and Velvet Falls. I was just thinking of calling it just mythology, because basically everybody just wants to be, get a little dignity, man. Just get a little feeling that they're like somebody, right? Doing something.
Yeah, but also isn't that sad a little bit?
Fuck yeah, because there's precious little given them, as my son said one day. Precious little is given, man. They might think they're really tough, they might act like they're tough, but basically their wives, their kids, or whoever say, well, you know, you got no degree, you're not that smart, all you do is watch football, you know. But yeah.
Yeah. What is given?
What is given, exactly. What is given and what is taken? There's the essence. There's the essence of human life. I knew we'd get really deep, man, here.
No,
really,
but I've actually been trying to sort this through with an article that I watched on. I watched the movie Oppenheimer and the movie Barbie.
Mm-hmm.
Both of which were good, but mm-hmm. I actually preferred the movie Barbie.
Mm-hmm.
You should actually watch it.
Mm-hmm.
I think you should.
Rolf said it was fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. Yeah.
And his 10-year-old daughter loved it too.
Yeah.
So you know it's a universal,
it's,
man.
It's a fucking miracle. It's a fucking miracle to make something that that like when you're an artist, you know you have to push people's buttons,
mm-hmm.
right? You know you have to hit a certain buttons, but like hitting the button sequence that it just works for everyone
right.
in the same way.
Right. Beautiful, beautiful.
Crazy.
It's beautiful just, planning. Yeah, planning, yeah, I mean, setting out, yeah, saying this is what I want to do, yeah.
Yeah, but it's also just unlikely. It's just like,
right.
It's just a...
Well, I'm sure there had to, I have to see it now, but I'm sure there's always an element, you know, in writing, and Saeed gets into this too, about how when you start writing, something else takes over, you know, some other energies take over. And that's the whole essence of good writing and good art, is you start it and some other energies start moving and changing it. And especially you got all these great actors, right? And
well, the problem is, right, the problem is in the middle of creating something, it's impossible to understand what it would be like to be the virgin person who is encountering your artistic representation for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And because that is impossible, you are constantly reverting to the idea of, okay, I need to go back to try and understand. And you're going back and back and back, and it all gets kind of mixed together, and mm-hmm. it becomes this loaf of bread where you're like either it's gonna rise or it isn't. Like at a certain point, you just gotta put it in the oven. You know, like it's like okay, I mixed it. I think I tried. Here. And,
I love it.
And either it's a loaf of bread or it isn't.
You know? Now, that was, you know, you got to tell your babe, that was a great metaphor.
No, I'm bad at them.
We're being
complaining. I'm bad at them, Will.
We're complaining.
I am bad.
I love it. I love it, man. And that yeast has got to be alive. And all of a sudden, it's like, it's on its own. That's beautiful, man. I love it. Yeah, I mean, that's what Edward C. said. And you said it better. And there's an excitement there, man, when it starts happening. And I think on the set, every actor, every, you know, cameraman, every sound man, they're all starting to feel it. They're all thinking, yeah, this is really fucking working good, man. We're feeling it. And I think that's why actors and people like that just love each other. You know, actually, they're pretty damn loyal to each other through the years. How often do you watch the Academy Awards and there are people applauding for 90-year-old men standing out there going, they can barely talk, right? Because those memories of when that happens, you know.
And that is my preferred version of loyalty.
Absolutely.
Like, there's this other version of loyalty that's just like, I can't get my hands around loyalty. Like, I can't grasp it. Every time I try and grasp the idea of loyalty, it slips through me, and I'm like, well, what are you talking about when you're talking about?
Yeah, you're right. If you haven't had that shared memory of that miracle,
yeah,
that's what really bonds people. You know, that really bonds people, and that's why the military bonds people. You know, in the best aspects. You know, of course, that is also.
But that's also manufactured.
That's also an illusion. It only happens like 1% of the time.
Yeah.
Most of the ex-military I know are just fucking pissed off. They feel like they've been betrayed and basically fucked.
Yeah.
By everybody.
Yeah.
And but you do run into people that were, you know, in a situation where everything was just happened that way. It only happens, I think, really. I mean, and that's the miracle of Shakespeare. He's working with a cadre of actors that are helping him with the diction, the delivery, ideas, right? You know they were feeling it, man. You know they loved each other. And, I mean, you never hear anything, anybody saying what a dickhead Shakespeare was. They all said he was just the fucking greatest, you know. But, yeah, that creative life, and you and I as writers who write in loneliness, right, we are experiencing when it happens alone, right? And what's really horrible is that sometimes when I think I've written really well, how fucking bad it is. And that's why, you know, the filmmakers, the directors, the actors, God, let's not leave out the people the casting directors that choose the people that are just going to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Let's not leave them out.
Let's not leave them out, man. Yeah. It's like, you know, I think that's why they're just, God, you just see them, man. Of course, they're living in California, you know, and they're, but yeah, to go through an experience like that and to feel when it all starts happening, you realize, yeah, we've got it, man.
Okay. I'm going to, this is a hard ask.
Okay.
Completely reverse your position. Be Faulkner after he's jaded being in Hollywood. Now talk about Hollywood. This is really hard, I know.
I think, now we need our research assistant that we haven't paid to look up and say, that's what true. Movies did Faulkner write the screenplay for?
He helped with that Marlowe one, the one that
I know that
Bogart was in.
So now we got to see it and make sure it's good.
It's fine, yeah, it's not
right.
bad.
Right, right, and Chandler did some other ones, right? Hey, look, we're talking about William Faulkner.
Yeah.
Who to me is a god.
No, yeah, you love William Faulkner.
It's
this
like,
is what I'm saying.
He,
like,
he is, William. They are fucking with him nonstop, and he's getting the money so he can keep the family home back in Oxford, right? And he is drinking like a fifth a day.
How writing, much is a fifth again?
Writing... Writing. This is our pre-podcast, gentle reader. We're working into the metrics of alcoholism. You know, fifths, 1.5 quarts. So, Pints. So, he writes Absalom, Absalom in California in 8 months while he's doing, while they're telling him his screenplays are no good. You know, I mean, he's going in there and he's dead at 61, Jonah. That says a lot. That really says a lot. I mean, fuck yeah. I mean, but isn't it wonderful to talk about the really wonderful things, you know? Like the Scorsese films that it just seems like Scorsese's just got the ability to just like get everything out of everybody.
Well, here's an interesting...
And where does Scorsese... I was thinking about him yesterday. Where does he get the knowledge to put these films together, man? And then I'm thinking, he just gets people around him and he listens to them. They're reminding him, okay, here's the scene. You've seen The Departed, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Are you kidding me?
It's a great movie.
So, I mean, where do you get this knowledge? I mean, I'm sure he had some memories, but the people that are putting it together for him, there's no way he could do this, man. And I think Scorsese is like the Shakespeare right now. I mean, just...
Yeah, but he didn't write anything.
But I think he knows, you're right, but I think he knows, he just knows how to listen to people and get the people to help him, but he's got the overall vision, but The Departed changes. You talk about how midway The Departed seems to change, man. Something really strange happens in that movie, and the viewing it, you're going, you have no idea what's going on, but you kind of feel this change in it. I think it's a great movie.
Yeah, no.
And guess what? Robbie Robertson was part of the soundtrack in that. He just died 2 days ago.
Oh, okay.
You remember the band?
Yes. Yeah.
Music from Big Pink, yeah.
Yeah. I believe Scorsese did a documentary about the band.
The Last Waltz, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the band was... I listened to Music from Big Pink, Jonah. And I remember when I first heard it on an 8-track, smoking some really good reefer and a little opium in Eugene, Oregon, 18 years old. And man, I thought that was the greatest music I've ever heard. But I heard it like, I got a record, I heard it like 7 years ago, and I'm going, man, these people are really fucked up, man. This is really slow, heavy, stone music. They are like alcoholics on heroin. I don't care, man. They're really fucked up. And that was the culture. But it was Vietnam, you know. It's like,
yeah.
Fuck, man, misery everywhere. People are coming home. They've really covered the Iraqi. The injured people of Iraq have just kind of like cut their limbs off and put them on medication and just taken care of them and hidden them. But in Vietnam, they were coming back and they were having to go to work, you know. They're kind of more out in the public than they are now. It's the same... Which gets us to an interesting problem about Foucault, we were talking about. Social structures.
Okay.
How individual human beings. See, that's the pessimism of Foucault, is there's really no individualism in Foucault. We're all social constructs, right?
Right.
And you just think about the social construct of the returning Vietnam veteran of my era and the returning Iraqi veteran of my sons are in their 40s, so it'd be people in their 50s, right? But totally different.
No, not necessarily.
Yeah, totally different. Totally different, man. It seems like everything's a lot fucking cooler after Iraq, right? Because we won, right? There it is. That's the key right there, man. We won the Iraqi war. Well, of course, we didn't.
Well, like the kid we were talking to that was in the bookstore before who, you know, had his foot crushed.
Right.
And has to go through this whole fucking saga of nerve damage, thinking about his foot, like doctors telling him bullshit about, you know, their own essence of what his foot should be. And like, you know, all of that is like beyond the political, you know, social sphere. That's like literal just nerves. That's personal. That's
right.
Like I have a friend who was in Iraq, and he was on one of these trucks that they send ultraviolet radiation to blow up land, like IUDs. And he was installing one of the IUDs, and he said he was done, and the guy flipped on the switch, and he was there, and he got a full blast of radiation in his chest, and like, that's how he got out of the army, was he got a full blast of radiation in his chest, and he's been on disability ever since. But, you know, he's still doing all right. He figured out a way to keep being alive. So,
well, see, that's the point I'm making. The Vietnam veterans came back pissed.
Yeah.
And the Iraqi veterans have just been kind of subsumed into this fabric, but the anger is still there and the pain. And you put it right, exactly right, man. It's all about nerves and 3 o'clock in the morning, man.
Yeah.
And how you deal as an individual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nerves and 3 o'clock in the morning. That'd be a good 1968 pop song.
Yeah. I'm telling you. I mean, I could just see it. You know, the mood is just totally different. There was so much overt anger after Vietnam on both sides. I mean, and there's been no anger after Iraq. And you drive down the street and you see guys going down the street with no legs in their chair, and they seem medicated, you know?
Yeah.
But,
well, there's definitely anger. There's just no way to express it.
Exactly, man. Well, it's there, and it's being expressed. And but, gosh, man. Yeah, people just don't realize. But anyway, yeah, back to the band, James Robbie Robertson. He died three years ago. And it was a dysfunctional band, man. I mean, Richard Manuel suicided. See, Manuel, Jamie Robertson broke up the band. He ended the band. And you talk about these, you know, these times where the band played these gigs that it all just kind of, like you said, it gets halfway into a set, and then all of a sudden everybody's just kind of into this transformative, transcendental experience, right? And that's what they were known for. And then all of a sudden, they get all this money, and Scorsese, and they're famous, and they're playing with Bob Dylan and everything, and all of a sudden, it just doesn't, it's not happening anymore, you know? Well, just like any marriage that goes bad, it's not happening anymore. And two of them die within 10 years, and everybody's pissed, and James Robbie Robertson just kind of goes along, and he finds his niche with Scorsese. But...
So yeah, the last couple weeks, I've been listening to an audiobook that's called Utopia Avenue, which is David Mitchell, who wrote Cloud Atlas, his take on a version of a fantasy 1960s pop band that makes it big in the UK and then comes to America. And he gets a lot of leeway about just like... name dropping Jimi Hendrix and, you know, Joni Mitchell and Janis Joplin and Leonard Cohen, and
they're all sleeping together.
Yeah exactly. Yeah.
That's what I learned from the Cohen book. They're all sleeping together, man. Sorry to interrupt you, go ahead.
No.
Well, like Jackson Brown.
He's a teenager.
He shows up
he's in Utopia.
He shows up at both Joni Mitchell and the gal from Nico from Velvet Underground, and he shows up. He's like 19 years old. He's ripped. He's a California kid, and she's like 28. And she says, "You're my guitar player." This is great. I mean, it's so wonderful. Go ahead, what you're saying.
Yeah, no. I mean, honestly, this is my diss against the novel. Is he gets just way too much legs out of just like name dropping people, you know, like being famous and then name dropping people also.
Right.
And it's kind of like, yeah,
right.
Whatever.
But I heard it's a good book though.
It's okay. I mean, yeah. what I'm saying is he gets too much. You know, it's like You don't have to write at that point. Because exactly. because you don't have to write characters. You right. you can already imbibe the book with characters that people already know.
Right. Well, at least he realized that he didn't have another novel in him, and so he's going to do this, man.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but...
Well, I was just talking to this gal today, you know, and really, really gorgeous, man. And I told her I was married. And we were talking, she's a brilliant, brilliant woman, and I was just saying that, you know, why do all these writers write these great books and then they write these, you know, just pieces of junk, right? Dead books, right? And it's because when you stop growing when you're writing, you know, when you stop going through the growth process and all this stuff that's going on, and it's not in that book. It's a dead book, man. I really believe that. What do you think of that? Can you really write a book without that excitement of the yeast suddenly going, okay, we're awake. Something's happening here. I mean, when you're in that position, you've got to ride with it. You've got to, like, you know, there's a lot of liability to that. What you wanted to write is not going to happen anymore. It's going to be something else. But I really believe that, man. I think it's all about growth.
Well, I mean, I would say you're definitely not wrong. I think the question is, yeast can go bad, right? I mean, like yeast can
interesting
overextenuate itself.
Like, right. Well, you're carrying it a little too far. The yeast is,
and
not,
this is why I'm bad at analogies. Yeast,
yeah. Well, you're 70%. No. Yeast is not a personal thing you have, man. Yeast is something that is the metaphor of the transcendental.
Right. Well, the extent that all of us exist in the transcendental state of...
Basically, like, writing is subversive. Art is subversive.
Yeah.
And at the point where there's no subversion, which includes the subversion of the subject, of the writer, you know, when the writer is no longer being subverted when he writes a novel or she writes a novel... or a poem or a song, it's not good anymore, man. That's what I'm saying. Mm. And I'm stand on that.
Yeah, but wouldn't everyone feel that way, more or less?
Oh, I mean, no, man. Fuck no, man.
Even if you've made it.
Hey, David Mitchell's got it made. He's going to make his money. He's going to get published. Yeah. It doesn't matter what he does. And, you know, why is he fucking doing... God, I was going to say, why is he doing podcasts instead of writing? But we're we're an exclusive club.
We have much more integrity.
Yeah, we have more integrity, man. Yeah. We're not influencers, right? Oh, my gosh, yeah. Well, with that caveat, so we're going on the river tomorrow.
Okay.
If you want to go, we'll take the raft. And man, you know, as you have found out, that raft is a lot safer than that two-man kayak.
Yeah. Wow.
That was still
so wonderful. So describe to me this other guy.
This guy is... He comes in... He came in yesterday, and he's a real big guy. And
big, like heavy? Like,
he's a big guy, yeah. He's
like,
a big guy.
Like, but you're talking like 320, something like that?
No. He's just a big guy. He's probably, you know, the classic 6 foot... 240.
Okay.
I'm 6'3 and 200. That gives you an idea.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's a big guy, but he is a great talker, and he knows everything about America, about North America. He will tell you if you mention some state, he can tell you something about it, you know. He knows a lot about environmental politics and environmental species in just about every state in the union. So I told him, I said, hey, well, I'm going on the river tomorrow. Jonah isn't answering my calls. And he called me today, so. But if we do it, we'll take the raft and we'll bring plenty of beer.
All right.
And so just let me know.
All right. And there you go.
If you come, it'll delay it, because I told him we could leave by 9. I don't think there's any chance I can do that. Jonah, this is one of the greatest. This one of the best ever, man. And thank you for 5 years. 7 years.
Five or seven. It's around
five there. Or seven. You round it off.
It's yeah. around there.
No, it's great, man. I love it.
Well, as soon as you see this, this is one of the benefits of not being popular is you don't have to qualify it.
Nobody's calling us. Say, hey, yeah. are you going to be at that writer gathering? And
yeah. Actually, yeah, yeah. No, no one's checking Kafka's backlog and being like, wait, did you actually record? Did you write this on January 12th yeah. or the 17th of April?
Yeah.
What pointless bullshit.
I'm glad you mentioned Kafka because we didn't mention him. I mentioned him earlier today. It's hard to let a week go by without mentioning Kafka. And I think I was talking about the fact that, or we did mention earlier, how he's, it's like 2 a.m, he's got a beautiful wife that loves, girlfriend that loves him. And it's 2 a.m, he's going, is this writing? Because he's working full time.
Yeah.
Is this writing more important than having a beautiful wife as my lover? And he goes, God, it is. I actually enjoy this more than being a human being, man. Just being a creature of language. And yeah, so we always got...
What are we supposed to think about that?
We're supposed to think about this guy realized how fucking crazy he was. Language and being a writer was more important than being a human being and having a life.
Well, what...
Which is just a faint reflection on you and I, basically.
Yeah, but what does he understand about the nature of love? I mean...
No, I think the madness of being a writer and experiencing those moments when you're just fucking one of the great writers in the world is just too overpowering. And he is, man.
Yeah, but I mean, he didn't know that.
He knew the excitement and the thrill of it.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I'm not in his league, so I don't have that problem. And I'm still attracted to beautiful women and hanging out and having a beer, right? So I'm not that temptation, you know, the great line of Christ, you know, please take this cup from me, you know, that cup is there, but you know, am I gonna fucking stand?
I wish this podcast had just been about you from the beginning, and then the title could be "At least I'm not in Kafka's league." Thank God.
Thank God, man.
To experience
that joy of being that good a writer. Holy moly, man!
Terrible.
3 a.m.
Horrible.
3 a.m. You're going fuck. God Almighty, man. And I don't know. Gosh knows, man. Who knows? Who knows? But I just do know it's madness. It's totally madness. And I mean Coleridge.
Yeah.
Shakespeare. They're all fucking crazy, man. They're all totally madness. I mean, why would you write all night long? You know, why would you get I just can't conceive of it. And that's how it happens.
Kafka's particularly crazy because, at least with Shakespeare, he definitely did have people around him who were slightly encouraging him mad.
No, exactly. Yeah.
But nobody was encouraging Kafka mad.
No, no.
Which is much more difficult. And why we should praise Kafka more, really, is because no one was praising him. No one was saying, like, hey, you should be a little bit more mad.
We shall praise Kafka more, man. Yeah. Oh my gosh, man. Well, unfortunately, when you bring Shakespeare into it, you know, that's like he's a god, man. He's just, there's no one that experienced pain like him. I think his ability to experience pain and just live a more normal life was just a miracle, man. Gosh, but yeah. But yeah, he was a man. He was staying out too late drinking. He died when he was 53. So Kafka, yeah.
I'm good gonna call deal. This the miracle of Shakespeare. And it's gonna
that
be,
he lived to be 50. That he lived to be 51. Yeah,
and it's
man.
Gonna be a completely disingenuous title because.
Fortunately, there was no heroin or cocaine. That's all we know, man. That's all we know.
There's no cocaine.
Cocaine. Oh, that would be a great video, Shakespeare going. Cocaine, staying up late, hanging out with the boys and the girls. Yeah. Well, let this be in our future, man. Let this be in our future. I'll have to talk to Sanaya about this. We stay up quite late, but we don't stay up partying quite late.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
When was the last time you did cocaine?
Oh, that was a long time ago. That was a long time ago. I was a working man. The next day was the longest day I've ever spent. I mean, the cocaine juice was like seeping through my pores all day long, man. In the summer. Speak of summer. Can you imagine doing a lot of cocaine free? It was laid out for me free, right? And
so you're gonna
no sleep that night. And then going to work when it's like 120 fucking degrees on a golf course and smiling at all the nice Republicans. Boy, this is a lot of fucking fun, man. I mean, I swear I could feel it just oozing through me. I knew, oh God, man, what a... Cocaine, to me, is like the essence. I'm thinking about it a lot. It's like I have always been extremely down and judgmental on people who do cocaine because the social things, how it's destroyed Mexico, right? But I'm reminded of this guy I knew in town who got popped for cocaine. And I always thought, God, what a dickhead, man. And he was embedded in the community, you know, he was of one of the ethnic power groups in town and but a nice guy. And he gets popped and he spends a couple of years in jail. And he comes out and he's on probation. And he gets drunk. And the next day, the keepers at the Ross Park Zoo are checking out the exhibits. And there is this guy, still drunk, in the mountain lion cage with his arm around this mountain lion. And the mountain lion and this guy are sitting there very happily kind of dozing together. And I thought, how could anybody criticize a man like that? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's like, God.
How can you criticize a man like that?
That story is worth 50,000 people. Yeah. That's a true story, and I'm going to get in my last novel one way or another. Jonah, thank you, man.
Well, the thing about getting something in your last novel is like getting something...
Not a high standard, is it?
Yeah. Well, no. It's like you got to kill your darlings, you know? It's like you try too hard to get it in. It's like...
I know. You kill your darling. Yeah. Put one more character in. Absolutely, man. That's love. That's good stuff, Jonah. Once again...
Cheers.
Cheers.